Coming up on Golf Today, a conversation with the chief legal officer of the PGA Tour on the heels of Tiger Woods joining the policy board. What other changes might be coming to professional golf? And speaking of conversations, Rocco Mediate stops by for a past champ chat on his two wins in Greensboro, his long-ago duel with Tiger, and much, much more. And a pro at 17, a PGA Tour winner at 21, Akshay Bhatia, making his voice heard on the professional stage and on this very show in moments. Akshay dropping the hammer on Golf Today.
Golf Today.
Golf Today on a Wednesday. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week magazine. Always things swirling, always something going on in the game of golf. Today is no different. In case you missed it, let's get you caught up on the news from yesterday. PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan and the tour's player members, player directors, and player advisory council members announced a new agreement to ensure that the tour lives up to its mission of being a player-driven organization for the players, by the players. As part of the new transparency and governance measures in the agreement, Tiger Woods has agreed to join the tour policy board as a sixth player director. The tour's new board will include six player directors, five independent directors, and the PGA of America director. Adam Scott earlier today in Greensboro on Tiger Woods.
Well, I think it's great for the tour. I think it kind of leaves a feeling in me and maybe some of the other players that shows how much Tiger cares about the future of the tour. And, you know, timing-wise for me going on the board next year, I think it'll be an incredible experience to sit on that board and have Tiger Woods on the board with me. And, you know, with the other guys that are on the board, I think we have looks like a really good makeup and a group of guys that care deeply about the future of the tour.
Last question here on that point. Do you feel like this, the news that came out yesterday, not just with Tiger, but the kind of the transparency agreement, do you feel like this kind of building a bridge kind of back between the players and the tour a little bit with how the news came out in early June with the framework agreement?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. You know, it's... I think it's the right thing to do. I think, you know, the players got together and acted really responsibly as members of the tour and push for what I think is very fair things, given the kind of way everything has gone down this year. And hopefully everything, you know, kind of runs a little more smoothly between the tour and the players going forward, and I think it will for sure.
And right now we are joined by the PGA Tour's Chief Legal Officer and Executive Vice President Licensing, Len Brown. Len, we appreciate the time. We've heard player reaction regarding Tiger Woods being named to the policy board. How would you describe the tour's reaction to this development?
Well, first of all, good afternoon. Good to see you both. We're excited. Having Tiger Woods on our board, it's incredible. You know, our player directors take the time running their busy schedules, running their business of golf, but they take the time because they care about the interests of the tour. Not just the tour that they're playing on, but the future of the tour. And clearly, Tiger is one of those individuals. I can't stress how excited I am to spend time with Tiger, learn from Tiger in all candor. But, you know, we tend to forget he's one of the greatest golfers of all time, but he's also a great businessman. So I think he adds such a great dynamic to an already strong board with Rory, Peter, you know, Patrick, Charlie, Webb. We're already, you know, very, very strong board, but Tiger is the cherry on top.
Len, the process by which player directors make their way onto the board is fairly regimented, as is the length of tenure that they serve on the board. Tiger's obviously an extraordinary addition to that board. Do bylaws already exist that permit this kind of addition to the board? And is there any sense or agreement on how long Tiger's actually going to serve?
Sure. So, you know, we moved swiftly. This is the third time, I would say, in the past 3 years that we've changed the number of directors on the board. We added a fifth independent director to balance it out. We added a fifth player director. And obviously now we have a sixth player director with Tiger. Our board quickly, unanimously, approved that measure on the other night. So, you know, we remain flexible. Our board does everything in its power, especially when we have an opportunity to strengthen our board and strengthen our tour.
We seem to be moving closer to an era when players are assuming more decision-making authority for the big decisions on the tour. And with that, it can be harder to distinguish between what is in a player's interest and what's in the broader interest of the membership. And there are people on the board who do have a commercial relationship with the tour. And there's never been any suggestion of anything improper. But what protections are in place to ensure that the decisions that are made are actually in the interests of the broader membership rather than any particular individual?
That's a good question. You know, every board member, regardless of whatever board they're on, is a fiduciary to that board, to that organization. And we have never had a problem with any of our players understanding that role as a fiduciary. And, you know, at times, making decisions for the greater good of the tour, current and future, that may impact them personally. But they see the value in the decision, and they see that, you know, their role is to be a shepherd of the game, a shepherd of the tour, and strengthen the tour at present, make the tour a better tour in the future, and respect the past.
Len, Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, after the hearings, told ESPN that he would consider subpoenaing Commissioner Jay Monahan, Greg Norman, and Yasser Al-Rumian. This time of year, we typically hear from Jay or see Jay, especially as the playoffs are about to begin. When can we expect to hear from Jay Monahan?
Sure. Well, Jay Damon's doing what Jay does best. He's out personally talking to players one-on-one. We've had two player meetings thus far since Jay's been back. We have a third scheduled for next week. Jay's doing what he does as a commissioner, and he's doing that thing as commissioner that he does so well, and it's the personal touch of Jay. So I will remind you, at the very latest, we have the tour championship and Jay will deliver the state of the tour. But for now, again, Jay's talking to players individually, sponsors individually, and getting back up to speed.
The announcement yesterday, Len, and Jay's memo to players last week had a lot of promises about governance reform, transparency. What does that actually look like in practice? What's going to change?
So, well, I think, you know, transparency, a synonym for that is communication. And I think communication is key. As we go forward with the framework agreement, you know, I'll remind you, that's going to have to be approved by our players. And our greater membership is represented by the PAC and the player directors. There has to be a lot of communication going both ways for us to get the ball across the finish line. So communication is transparency, and we will continue to strengthen that. And frankly, though, use caution when we have to. Negotiations are complicated, as you know, and there are calls at times for confidentiality. But that said, our player directors will be in the middle of those negotiations, and they will know everything as it happens.
Putting transparency in the context then of communication, but confidentiality, was it permissible under the tour's existing governance structures for the commissioner and two members of the board to reach such a seismic decision that seems to have players so upset?
Well, so I'll remind you, Eamon, what that agreement did was get rid of a very distracting litigation. And that's really it. We set forth a framework that will be discussed, that's being negotiated currently, that had some guidelines in it. And I think folks got confused a bit that those guidelines were in place, but they were the guardrails under which we decided to move forward with the negotiation. So did the commissioner have the right to get rid of a distracting litigation? Absolutely. Does the framework agreement, as written, have the obligation that the full board has to approve it? Absolutely. And does our full board include our player directors, now our six player directors, including Tiger Woods? Absolutely. So there really isn't a governance issue there. But that said, we understand the communication and the transparency issue. And again, as I said earlier, we're working for greater communication going forward.
Len, a few weeks ago at the behest of the DOJ, the provision in the framework agreement regarding the poaching of players was removed. What is the status of the DOJ inquiry at this point?
So again, we don't have an agreement, Damon. We are in contact with the DOJ. When we have an agreement, we welcome their comments on it. We have been engaged with the DOJ for over a year, and they're doing their jobs and we're doing our jobs. So once we have a definitive agreement in place, we will continue our conversations with the DOJ.
Obviously a fairly turbulent last couple of years, to put it mildly, Len, and particularly in the last few months. But with this player push for more involvement, more decision-making authority, does this in any way represent a vote of no confidence in the executive leadership of the tour?
Eamon, I don't think so. And frankly, you'd have to ask the players. But I will say, you know, I've been at the tour almost 18 years. It'll be 18 years in December. And the last 2 to 3 years have been the most volatile. And we've, as golf, and you report on us as a sport, we haven't had the magnitude of things that have occurred to us. So like any other company, like any other management team, we move quickly to adapt and to do what we think is right for the tour. Back to your point of communication, at times you're moving so fast, it's hard to communicate with everyone. But even in the decisions that were made in that time period, it was done within the governance and properly approved.
Transparency is important when it comes to the players. It's also important when it comes to the fans. What is the tour's message to the fans at this point in this turbulent period in our game?
Yeah, I guess the message to the fans is hold on. I mean, I think we're at a turning point, and this potential deal that we're doing has the power to transform the game and unify the game like never before globally. So for our fans, we want to continue to do everything in our power to allow our players to give you the best golf in the world. But we're looking to turbocharge what we have and make it even better.
Len, we always appreciate a few minutes of your time. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you both. Have a great afternoon.
And you, Len Brown with the PGA Tour. Fascinating times. I just wonder, Eamon, how can all of the players get in lockstep when they've never really always been in lockstep? And is Tiger Woods the person who can help find cohesion in these turbulent times?
In a way, Tiger represented the fact that players never really took a lot of interest in the governance of their own tour. Tiger was never really involved in the internal politicking of the tour at all. Mm. And the fact that he's doing that now, I think, speaks to the importance of the moment that we're actually in here. I do think it is something of a player rebellion here. We've heard of pitchfork rebellions. This is the pitching wedge uprising from these guys here. But at a certain point, everyone involved in this, the tour and the players, they're losing sight every day of the core product and the core fan here. And it's becoming a real cancer in this game that fans do not like. They go to sport to avoid politics and avoid money. And that's all they hear about in golf these days. And the players would do well to realize that the relationship between the core fan and the core product here diminishes just a little bit every passing day.
So why I ask the question, because inside the ropes, the game has been good. It's been fascinating. It's been fun. There have been amazing stories, whether it's designated events or non-designated events, fantastic play, players of all, you know, styles getting the job done and winning, from the big bad John Rahm to itty-bitty Brian Harman. I too wonder if all this talk of money, and thankfully the litigation at least at this point has been put to the side, but I just wonder, will there come a point where the fan is just weary of all this talk about money, 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 and turns elsewhere? I miss the charity. Charity used to be almost always front and center on almost every conversation. Tour stops, what hospitals are being affected, what first tee programs are going to be, you know, impacted by the tour's presence in said city, Memphis, Greensboro, you know, pick your spot. And those stories, to me, over the last couple of years, have been lost.
They have, and I mean, they're still out there, I guess. It becomes less of a focus. And I don't see the money or internal politics of the tour necessarily going away as a story anytime soon, because we have until the end of the year where this framework agreement will be negotiated with the Saudi investment fund. And if that doesn't happen, there is a movement certainly among some players out there, in some cases publicly, to look for a private equity solution, an alternative to the public investment fund, since the tour has committed to the idea of a for-profit entity. There is an opportunity there for clean capital, as it were. So I think it's not going to go away anytime soon, that's for sure.
You know, my late father told me to go to law school. I went to journalism school instead. Maybe I should have gone to law school as well.
You would have been on the more profitable end of this enterprise. Well, on other matters, Stuart Sink. He's played on 5 Ryder Cup teams, and now he's about to trade his clubs, and this for a cart and a walkie-talkie. Just named as Zach Johnson's 5th and final assistant captain for the matches in Rome, and we're going to hear from the former Open champion coming up next.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
August is here, which means we're less than 2 months from the Ryder Cup, which will be contested at Marco Simone in Rome. World number one Scottie Scheffler and U.S. Open champ Wyndham Clark have already officially qualified for the U.S. team. Take a look at the standings at this point. Top 6 will automatically qualify. I think Captain Zach Johnson will make 6 captain's picks just on the outside at number 13. The guy who won the match play this year, Sam Burns. With more on Sam Burns and the Ryder Cup, let's welcome in Todd Lewis from Greensboro. Hey, T. Lou.
Hi there, Damon. You look at Sam Burns. He's currently 20th in the official world golf ranking. He's 19th in the FedEx Cup standing, so he's a safe lock, obviously, to make it to the playoffs. He's got a pretty good shot at returning back to Eastlake for the Tour Championship. So why is he playing the last regular season event on the PGA Tour schedule? Well, he's trying to impress Zach Johnson, by the way, who is in the field here at the Wyndham Championship, and hopefully become a captain's pick for the United States Ryder Cup team. He's never been part of the Ryder Cup team. And I caught up with Sam after his pro-am round today, and we talked about the importance of him wearing the red, white, and blue in Rome.
You know, I'd be lying if I said it wasn't, you know, the biggest goal I had coming into this year. And so, you know, I have basically 3 events left to try to convince Zach that I need to be on that team. So, coming out here this week, just trying to prepare really well and trying to do everything I can to be in the best shape possible to try and win a golf tournament. I think, at this point, I hope I play well enough to not really make it a hard decision. But ultimately, you know, whatever happens, I'm good either way. If I'm on the team, great. If I'm not, I'll be supporting those guys. So we'll see.
You were on a U.S. team not far down the road at Charlotte, the President's Cup. I know you're not a prideful person, but if you had to assess what you could bring to the team, what would you say?
I love team atmosphere. I grew up playing a lot of team sports, and I loved being a part of them. I think, to be able to play for something bigger than yourself is obviously really important. It's how a lot of us guys out here try to approach these weeks. It's a little more difficult when it's just us out there. But being able to go out there and give it all for your teammates and your captains and your country, it just means more. And so I hope that, if I am a part of that team, I can, those guys know that I'm going to go compete as hard as I can and try to do everything I can to help the team win.
All right, the pros of having Sam Burns on that United States Ryder Cup team: he's very close with Scottie Scheffler, who's already a lock. He's already made the United States Ryder Cup team. They match up well, both in games and personality. Secondly, he did win the WGC Dell Technologies match play earlier this year, so he's a great match play player. But you look at his form, he hasn't had a top 10 since Colonial earlier this year, so he really has to play well over the next few weeks to impress Zach Johnson. Well, if he does make the team, he will have an assistant captain that was just named this week in Stuart Sink. Zach Johnson picking his good friend Stuart Sink to be the 5th vice captain for the United States team. And Stuart is in the field here at the Wyndham Championship, and I talked to him about the honor of being on that team as a vice captain. First off, the pride and the honor that you have from getting that call from Zach to be a vice captain, how would you describe it?
Yeah, it is an honor, and feels great just to be able to, hopefully contribute to something good to lead the team to a win. I love playing for the U.S., and I just am so looking forward to being on the leadership team.
Yeah. What do you want to bring to the team specifically?
I think experience, you know, kind of goes both ways, good and bad. So I can kind of like, you know, we all, as we get older, we kind of like, you have mistakes that you learn from. And not just going back to team events, but just in my years of playing like 600 and something tournaments out here, you know, I've kind of learned the hard way in a lot of ways. So I've always enjoyed that mentor role with younger players. And I think most of the Ryder Cup team is going to be younger than me. So I can bring that to the team and alongside Davis and Jim and Steve and of course, Zach. And Freddie, it'll be, I think we can make a good team and make some good decisions.
And Stuart Sink is very well respected on the PGA Tour. He is very well liked, although he does spend some time on the PGA Tour Champions. Most of his play is still on the PGA Tour. You heard him talking about mentoring young players. Again, let's not forget, the United States hasn't won the Ryder Cup on foreign soil in Europe since 1993. And there will be some rookies on that team. Wyndham Clark is already on that team. Brian Harman, virtually a lock to be on that team. Cam Young could be on that team. You heard from Sam Burns. So there will be some players who will experience the pressure of Ryder Cup play in Rome, and having someone like Stuart Sink on that team to keep them motivated, keep them calm, will be a bonus. Guys?
Todd, before you go, we've had some shocking video emerge from North Carolina that would suggest there's actually some athletic ability in your family. This is your daughter, Addison.
Would you like to? Oh, yes. My daughter is a great athlete. She's 7 years old. Addison, last night, her and I went out to the Greensboro Grasshoppers game, which is the local minor league team, and we threw out the first pitch. I was first, and then she followed. It was kind of like Milli Vanilli opening up for U2, you know, get the bad band out of the way and then bring the big ticket event at Addison and have her throw the first pitch. But yeah, it was a great time. The Greensboro Grasshoppers, I've been going to that stadium for a long time because I'm from the area. Donald Moore, the president of the Grasshoppers, we appreciate your hospitality. It was a lot of fun.
She had a lot more heat on hers than he had.
Well, Addison has some athletic ability. Thank God for Melanie, because it comes from mom, well, not from dad.
Yeah, well, that's true. And Damon, let me just tell you, getting some athletic criticism from you is something that I will definitely take notes from. I appreciate that.
You got it, buddy. Anytime, that's what I'm here for. Great to have T-Lou on this Wednesday afternoon from Greensboro. Folks, when Golf Today continues, the past champs chat with a guy who's won twice in Greensboro, Rocco Mediate, 60 years of age, forever young, next on Golf Today.
We're back on Golf Today. A reminder that you can catch live first-round coverage of the final regular season event on the PGA Tour this Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. It's the Wyndham Championship on Golf Channel. Back in 1993, in what was then called the Greater Greensboro Open, Rocco Mediate birdied the fourth playoff hole to defeat Steve Elkington. Rocco overcame a double bogey on his 15th hole in that final round while saving par on the second and third playoff holes before claiming his second PGA Tour victory.
2002, Rocco became a two-time winner in Greensboro. Shot a final round one under par 71 to beat Mark Calcavecchia by three. It was Rocco's fifth tour win and first for him since the 2000 Buick Open. And Rocco's been around a long time. Goes back to Florida Southern College. 03 Hall of Fame inductee, by the way. Six PGA Tour wins. The first player to win on tour, by the way, using a long putter back at the Doral Ryder Open in 91. Four PGA Tour champions wins, including the 2016 senior PGA. And, of course, that memorable duel with Tiger Woods in the 2008 U.S. Open at Torrey Pines. Time now for Past Champ Chat with Rocco Mediate. It's great to see you. Let's talk about those two wins, one against Steve Elkington, another against Mark Calcavecchia. What do you remember about your time in Greensboro?
I love Greensboro. It was like my second home. I'm from Greensburg, PA, so it was kind of matched. You know, I had a lot of good friends. They're good show. My daughter's hitting balls over here. Nice swing. It was a great place. I liked it there. Like I said, good buddies. And just, I don't know, I played good. I loved Forest Oaks. I enjoyed it. Forest Oaks was nasty. Nasty golf course. Reminded me of home, so.
Rocco, that was your second win on tour. You ended up with five career wins. When you got to the 2002 was your fifth career win. A lot of those intervening years were lost to injury. When you look back on it, are you content with what you accomplished, or does part of you still wonder what might have been without the injuries?
No, yeah, I'm pretty, I would say content. I mean, obviously, we all wanted to do better. But yeah, I mean, I had some things that happened. You know, we all do, though. It's like, there's a lot of injuries in every sport, really. But golf, as you guys have seen, it happens. So you got to deal with it. And yeah, I would say I'm pretty content. I always tell people, I wish I would have chipped and putted a little more back in the day. I might have won a couple of more events, you know. I wish I'd have done that. I mean, you know, maybe I regret not working as hard as I probably should have on around the greens and putting. No, I don't really have any regrets, really. I mean, I did all I could. You know, I picked the clubs out of the car one day in 1993-ish. I think it was, yeah. And I felt something, and that was it. In 94, I had surgery after the U.S. Open, basically, at Oakmont.
Rocco.
So I just dealt with it and went from there. Go ahead.
Way back in 06, you opened up a vein. We sat down together. I featured you in a piece for the New York Times going into Wingfoot in the 06 U.S. Open. You talked about overcoming injury and all these starts. You said Rocky 3, Rocky 4, Rocky 5. You talked about a little too much online poker that you had gotten into and pulled yourself out of that. What kept you going through some very dark periods?
Yeah, there's been some, there's been some interesting times, we'll call it. Some dark, some interesting. But nothing like horrible, horrible. But yeah, I don't know. I just love what I do, and I wanted to keep doing it. And I knew the certain paths I was on, there's no chance to do it. And I just kind of went that way with it. And I'm still doing that now. I'm trying to still, you know, I'm still playing. I love it. I'm 60 now, and I feel 30. So, you know, it's just a matter of what – I didn't really want to do anything else. Let's put it that way. I didn't really want to do anything else. So I try to stay with it. And overcoming that injury was monstrous. It was huge. And, you know, it lingered for a while, but I haven't been bothered in years and years and years by it. So I don't even remember last time it put me down. But I don't know. It's just one of those things. I just love what I do. I love playing on the tour. That's all I've ever done. Since I was 21, I'm on the PGA Tour the whole time. And I'm 60 now. So I don't know anything else, really.
Rocco, your first tour event was the 84 U.S. Open at Wingfoot. Here you are, almost 40 years later. You give the impression of a man who's actually enjoying golf more now than he did at any point in his life.
Yeah, I love it. I do like it. I remember qualifying for Wingfoot at Sharon Golf Club in Ohio, and I don't know that I won the qualifier. Anyway, I qualified. And I remember seeing everything there. You know, the golf balls were awesome. Had 1984 U.S. Open on the golf balls, the Titleist balls in the range, the bags, the golf course. You know, the Wingfoot is just awesome. And I remember when I was walking to the first tee on Thursday, my dad said, you looked white as a ghost. I was so scared. I didn't know what to do. I mean, I'd played golf, but not real golf like that. And it was cool. And I remember saying, boy, I really kind of want to do this like forever now. that's been a long time. I'll never forget that, though. I birdied. I do remember this. This is cool. The first round, you know, I don't know what I started out with. I might have made a six in the first hole. But anyway, I birdied 15, 16, and 17 on Thursday. This is some punk kid. I can't play dead at all back then. And I hit an 8-iron. Listen to that. I hit an 8-iron to 18 in 1984. Think about that for a second. That's how different the hole is now. But and I missed about a 12-footer. I would have been the only one at that time, I don't know if it's happened since, to birdie the last four holes in any U.S. Open, any round, they told me after, which was kind of cool. I remember that. Then I shot 77 or 8 the next day, missed the cut. But I played about as good as I could play then. So huge experience. You know, and then I fell in love with USGA then because I just love the difficulty and the narrowness of the fairways.
Rocco, I played golf with you once at Totter Ridge in Western PA, and you played barefoot. How often do you still practice and play barefoot?
I always do. I've always liked it. I like the feeling. I like the balance aspects. Some of the instant, why do they have any shoes on? Well, because I don't want to have shoes on. It's really simple. It's definitely helped. It helps balance. I mean, if you see some of the guys, not that the way they swing now is different. Okay, you know, Free always taught us back. Jim Free always taught us when I first started. The best strikers were flat-footed at impact. Flat-footed impact. Well, that's changed, obviously. And not in a bad way. It's just changed. You know, the guys hit it 7 miles, and they have to do certain things. But so that's why I always do that. Footwork is not – it's important now, and it was important then. It's just different important now. Their feet got to get the heck out of the way, or they rip their hips to shreds. Ours didn't. You know, we didn't move the club as fast as they did. So flat-footed. So I, you know, Jim would say, hit me some balls barefoot in the dew. Don't fall down. So he, that's how I learned. So I still do it.
Well, from the barefooted to the well-heeled, what do you look at the tour these days, Rocco, and you see all of the talk of money and the politicking? What are you and your fellow guys on the PGA Tour Champions locker room, what do you think when you see what is going on the tour these days?
We kind of laugh what's going on, because it was doing just fine. I think we were always told, and you've heard this a million times from probably a million different players, we were always told, if you want more, if you find yourself complaining, if you find yourself not happy, play better. That's all. I remember Dean Beeman said that to us in our first meeting, the fall of 85, when I got my card. He said, you're going to find yourself mad. You're going to find yourself jealous of your buddies because they're kicking your butt. You're going to find yourself this and that. To fix that, you play better. And we'll give you things you don't ask for. That's what he said in 1985. And it's still that way, but it's not that way. Now they're saying, we got to take care of the top guys. And I get it. They're the draw. But that's not how it used to be. The best guys, if you played the best, that's what you got. You got more. You made more money. You won tournaments, all that stuff. Now it's like, we're going to give them this. We're going to do that. Just play. I don't understand what's going on. The whole live thing threw a wrench into it that was silly. I know how you guys feel about it, but I feel the same way. And I don't know what's going to happen. I know I'm so happy Tiger's in the mix. And now it's an even ball game, basically. I still think the players should have the upper hand because it's our tour. I say our tour, but you know what I mean. It's their tour. So it should be what they want to do, not what anybody else wants to do. And hopefully it's leaning that way. I don't study it that much, but I just don't like the way it happened and the way some of these players. I said this, and this is the last thing I'll mention. Yes, what's going on? And we talk about it all the time. The PGA Tour, if you're Tiger Woods down, and I use me because it's funny. If you use Tiger Woods at the top of the mountain, me and somewhere down at the bottom of the mountain in golf, right? The people below us, below me, if there are any, and the people in between Tiger and myself, which there are. The PGA Tour gave us an opportunity to become whatever it is we became. An 83-time winner, a 6-time winner, a 1-time, whatever. Guy that played the tour 20 years, didn't win, still had a great career. Well, now that's not good enough. I don't get it. I never understood it. It's like you're going to slap in the face the very entity that gave you life. Was there mistakes made? Probably. I don't know. But are they leaning towards making it better? It looks like they are. And the PGA Tour is the best game in town. I don't care what anybody says. You got the live guys. I mean, the guys busting the PGA Tour's butt. And I would always say, so what'd you watch last weekend? Oh, the PGA Tour? Yeah, I figured you did. So please, let's just see what happens. But I think with what they're trying to do now, it might solve the issues. But we'll see.
Play better. Great advice in the 80s. And I think it's great advice today. Yeah. Rocco, we appreciate it. Enjoy the time with your daughter. We'll speak to you soon.
We will. Anytime, lads. Take care.
Well, from age and guile with Yako, Rocco, to youth and innocence with Akshay Bhatia. He won on the PGA Tour a couple of weeks ago and then found out it didn't qualify him for the FedEx Cup playoffs. We're going to talk with him right after the break to find out why. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Golf Today. Let's take a trip down memory lane. 2019 at the Valspar Championship, a 17-year-old Akshay Bhatia teed it up in his first PGA Tour event as the world number one ranked junior player with plans to skip college, turn pro, but ultimately missed the cut in his first PGA Tour appearance. But just a few weeks ago, as a 21-year-old, already in his fifth year as a pro, earned his first tour win at the Barracuda Championship. He had a dramatic putt in the 72nd hole to match Patrick Rogers with 40 points
in the Stableford format, but then defeat Patrick on the first hole of a playoff to claim victory and become a full-time PGA Tour member. And Akshay Bhatia joins us now for the Wyndham. Akshay, it's great to spend some time with you. You turned pro at the age of 17. You dealt with injury. You had folks criticizing you. What's it been like the last couple of weeks in this newfound life as a PGA Tour winner?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously great to finally get my first win on the PGA Tour, and everything that happened was pretty crazy. I mean, my heart was pounding, arms were shaking, and just knowing you had to putt, you know, to get hopefully in a playoff, and for everything to happen the way it did, it was great. And it's kind of great because I don't feel much different. I mean, just being able to have special temporary membership this year was obviously kind of a shock to the system, knowing that all of a sudden I was supposed to play Korn Ferry and now I'm playing on the PGA Tour. So it's been great. It's nice to be out here and in a home state event and not worry about a sponsor invite. So it's a pretty pleasing feeling.
Actually, that special temporary membership that you had also comes into play because after you won, you were fairly clear in thinking that you'd done enough to get yourself into the FedEx Cup playoffs, but the PGA Tour has fairly Byzantine rules about how you accumulate points and how many you accumulate, so you're not actually in the playoffs yet. At what point did you find out that you hadn't actually done enough with the win to get there?
Yeah, I actually found out the day I won, which, you know, is unfortunate. I know the PGA Tour has rules, and, you know, I'm just excited that I'm a, you know, PGA Tour member. I have all the perks next year playing Century and the players and the PGA Championship where I actually won the Junior PGA. So it is a bummer a little bit, but, you know, it is what it is. Hopefully I have a good week here and just kind of keep earning my way into the playoffs this season.
Did you make peace with the PGA Tour's decision? Did they explain it in a way that made sense to you, or did you kind of push back and say that maybe this should change going forward and that the win should allow the full allotment of points?
I understand the rule. I mean, it was about guys who are coming from, you know, DP World Tour, Asian Tour, whatever it may be, and you know, they're taking up spots for guys who have played on the PGA Tour, earned their spots in WGC events. And I know Shane Lowry was the last guy to do it, but, you know, I think it was a pretty unique situation for me to be a special temporary member and for it to happen and, you know, not coming from a different tour. I don't think many people expect this to happen, especially from a special temporary member. So, you know, hopefully... you know, they have a decision. I know the PAC is kind of having some meetings about it, and it is what it is, though. I mean, I'm excited to have a full schedule next year and kind of pick and choose where I'm going to play. And, you know, I still got a good opportunity here to solidify my spot.
Have you looked at the various permutations that you might need this week, actually, to crack into that top 70? You're 99th right now. Do you know what it's going to take?
I mean, a good week, right? Probably a top five or a top three, but I'm just kind of focused on playing good golf, trying to win a golf tournament. It's kind of been my motto. I knew I was really close starting John Deere. I knew it was close to for something good to happen, and kind of played in my favor. And coming into this week, I obviously took a nice break playing 4 weeks in a row, so I needed it for sure. But feeling a little rusty, not sharp, but I feel like once I kind of get into that tournament setting, it's going to be all good.
Actually, turning pro at the age of 17, that's a bit of a leap of faith. You've talked about what your girlfriend has meant in your journey. How about your parents? I understand they sacrificed a lot for you, worked very hard for you to be able to pursue your dreams.
Yeah, I mean, my parents, I owe everything to them, obviously. My dad traveled with me. He retired pretty young with some health issues, but he traveled with me. He took me everywhere. He was the one that kind of said, we're making this decision. And, you know, however people tell me it's not right, it's going to be right. And, you know, I had a lot of trust in him, and he had a lot of trust in himself, obviously. And it's always nice to look up to your dad like that. But, yeah, I mean, he just did certain things a little differently. We played Monday qualifiers when I was 15, 16. I was playing mini tour events when I was 12, 13, and I was just kind of always one step ahead. So my dad kind of made me just kind of realize what it takes to grind it out, honestly, you know, on mini tours and Monday qualifiers and those feelings. And my mom worked two jobs for a long time. She always supported our whole family. And my sister and I, you know, we played golf. We had to play, pay for tournaments, pay for travel, and it was never easy, but they did everything they could to get me here. And, you know, hopefully I can create a good life for everyone in my family. And you know, it's just an exciting time for everyone that supported me.
Well, it culminated in that great birdie on the 72nd hole and then the par to win in the playoff. Congrats on the victory and best luck this week at the Wyndham.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Still to come on Golf Today, we're staying in Greensboro as the tournament director for the Wyndham joins the show. Beach balls and sandcastles. What is the week like for him as the tour's best take on Sedgefield? And we're back on Golf Today. It's flashback to 1995 when our friend and colleague Jim Gallagher Jr. fired a final round 66 to win the Greater Greensboro Open. Started the final round seven shots off the lead, but rallied to secure his fourth career win on the PGA Tour. Man played collegially at Tennessee, turned pro in 83, five PGA Tour wins in 546 events played, competed in the Ryder Cup and the President's Cup, took down Seve, if I recall, in 93, and inducted into the Mississippi Sports Hall of Fame in 2022. And great to have Jim Gallagher Jr. for a past champs chat. Joining us from Greensboro, what do you remember about that final round? You beat Jeff Sluman and Peter Jacobson by a single shot.
This is a true story. So I'm staying at Harold Moose's house out in High Point, and I quickly grabbed a couple donuts to go out there, chase it down with a Dr. Pepper, and I shoot, I don't know, three or four under the front nine, so I have another donut at the turn, and I was on a complete sugar high. I was seven back, end up, it's not what all the kids should be listening to. I'm not the example you should be, but I guess about six donuts later and a Dr. Pepper, I pulled off a comeback to win by seven, but it was a cold, miserable day. I felt like if I got off to a good start, it would all turn out. But that's a true story. I'm not making it up. But it was really cool to be staying at Harold's and have Sissy there and the kids and on a really cold day to make that great comeback.
Maybe donuts and Dr. Pepper should be my strategy for this game going forward, Jim.
Since I can't teach you, that's what you should do.
Now, you also won later that year the FedEx St. Jude Classic, as it was known back then, in Memphis. That gave you five wins at 34. You never won after that. What happened after 1995 with your game?
That's a great question. I think I kept trying to put so much pressure on myself that I had to play to a level, you know, five-time tour winner on the Ryder Cup, and I put so much expectations and pressure on myself, it strangled me, and that's the truth of it. My kids were getting to that age where they were traveling and they quit traveling, but it was all on me. My golf swing wasn't where it should be. I got kind of lost. I lost my confidence. It's hard to believe you could go from, you know, I see JT struggle a little bit. It was never to the point where I got to where I end up walking away from it. But it proves that there's like stages of it where you think it'll never happen to you. And then all of a sudden it could happen to you. And then when it's happening to you, you're going like, how do I keep it from happening? And I went through all of those and it was just tough. I just lost some confidence. And I wouldn't say I fell out of love with the game, but you know, not playing very well, it made it very tough. And I kind of got stepped away in 2000 and spent, you know, a lot of time at home, which I cherished. But, yeah, I got kind of lost and lost my confidence.
Six donuts and Dr. Pepper to win at Greensboro. Yeah. What'd you have before you beat Seve in the Ryder Cup? What do you remember about that moment? Because that might be your most, you know, identifying moment in your golf career.
Well, I was actually supposed to play Sam Torrence, and then he had a medical problem, and they then put the name in the hat, and Lanny Watkins' name was in the hat, so they then spared off. They have that match, which put me up against Seve. I didn't find out till like, I don't know, 8 o'clock in the morning, so I didn't have time to be nervous. And I remember walking off the first tee, and I tell this story all the time, and I heard him turn around to Bernard Gallagher, who was their captain, and he says, I'll beat him, you know, 7-5 or whatever. And I turned around to Lanny Watkins and Tom Watson, who was our captain. I said, it might go the other way. And it kind of motivated me where I never felt there was the pressure. I mean, no one expected me to win but me and my wife and maybe my mom and dad that were over there. But, I mean, it was so cool. It was a cold day. We made a great comeback, and you know, it's been 30 years since the Americans won on foreign soil. So we'll see if that changes here in another month or so.
Jim, you've been around this tour a long time. Yesterday was a pretty remarkable day in terms of this agreement between the tour and its players in terms of greater transparency. And all we seem to hear about these days in this soap opera, every episode, it's governance, it's dollar signs, it's transparency, things like that. Is there a danger that the game, the tour, is kind of losing sight of the core product and the core fan and what the fan wants to see instead of hearing about these theatrics over politics and money?
I think that's what you got to stay away from. I mean, we all got into the game because we loved it. We didn't play for the money. Of course, it is you're playing for money, obviously, but we did it because we loved it. But you're right. I mean, I just felt like the players didn't feel like they had a voice. And they call it a player-run organization. It's probably a player input organization. The tour may be thinking they're making the best moves for them. But I hate the fact that we're talking about money. We're not talking about winning. And it's a clouded. I think golf was in such a great position, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. And now we're fighting amongst each other. And I get why the other guys left. I understand that. That's their choice. But I fear for the sponsors who are out here, maybe like here in Greensboro, Wyndham, being able to keep up with all these, increases in purses. How can you continue that? Because I feel like if you just stay the same, the guys are still going to play. They're not going to not play. But we're talking about money and not winning championships. And I think that's what we all got into it. And I hate the fact that there's that kind of, it's kind of tarnished. And not that it was squeaky clean at all, but it was a game we all did it because we loved it. We didn't do it for any other reason other than love for the game.
When you see these huge sums being initially thrown around by Liv and then the tour starts scrambling to keep up and sponsors are trying to keep pace as well, has the game and the players in it kind of gotten a skewed sense of what their market value is? And does it tarnish the tour's legacy in a way to have this suddenly become the focus?
I think they have to be aware of that. I think they need to listen to what some of the players. I still feel like you have to have people running it to make decisions, but the players need to have that input. But yeah, they need to really pay attention because now all we're talking about is money. How do you keep up with it? It's an arms race that I don't know that the PGA Tour obviously can't keep up with. And the sponsors, not fair to them. I mean, I just watched for years. We have tournaments that would be somewhere for 30, 40 years, and they get wiped aside because they couldn't come up with a bigger purse. And that affects so many people in the smaller communities to get to see professional golf that I hate to see that because there's so many great events. And I think there's only two of the tournaments I won that are still around. And you saw those tournaments that had all that great history, and they're gone because they couldn't keep up with the purse increases. And I worry that and fear that can happen. And all we're talking about is, hey, if you can't keep up, you're out. I hope we don't get to that point.
Jim, you love this game as much as anybody I know. You grew up in a golf family. You married into a golf family as well. I believe you're in 7 Hall of Fames, including the Mississippi Sports Hall of Fame. That one in particular you were inducted into last year. What was the significance of that, being inducted into the Mississippi Sports Hall of Fame?
My wife went in the year before, and I think that was, or maybe the 2 years before, and to be in there together with her. And think of all the great athletes that are in the state of Mississippi. Now, I grew up in Indiana. And was raised there, you know, up until I went to college. But I've lived in Mississippi over half of my life. And to be in there with the great names like the Archie Mannings and guys like that, and Walter Paytons and all those great players and athletes, it's just amazing that they would think of a golfer good enough to be in there amongst them. But to go in with Sissy, it was special. To have the kids there that night, it just I felt like when my kids were young, they weren't able, a couple of the older ones were able to be part of that, but I think they thought I won my trophies on eBay, that I really didn't win them, and they got to see what I accomplished, and I'm really proud of that, and I look back at it as you get older, you get a little more nostalgic, but that was a very special moment for me to a state that really adopted me as a kid moving down from Indiana 34 years ago.
Jim, what is Sissy's lesson rate? Because clearly I've been begging the wrong golfer in the family for a lesson.
You have. She's very expensive, and we're at Furniture Land South now, so if you want to pay the bill for that, maybe we could, whatever we come out of with today, maybe that's something you can pay her in that. But she'd probably give you a tip or two. I don't think she'd charge you. I think she'd give you a free lesson.
You came up in the era, Jim, when Q School existed. You were really playing for your living back then. We've had a lot of conversations this week about, going from 125, making the playoffs, to 70. What do you think is the ideal cutoff point there? Is 70 too few? Is 125 too high?
70 seems like a real playoff, doesn't it? I think it does for that part if you're looking at playoffs. As far as tour school, I wish they would increase that number a little bit more, maybe 10 or 15, because, I mean, I made it through tour school at TPC Sawgrass, and talk about nervous, having to play 17 six different times in December when the weather could change like that. It was a big part of it, and it's so much drama. And you're going to see drama here with guys trying to finish in the top 70, but they still have an opportunity to keep playing. I think it's that number, whether it's the 125 or tour school, is where the drama is for guys trying to keep their dream alive and for a lot of guys to kind of keep that career going or whatever. But I think that the pressure, you'll see top 70, but there still is a second life after this for some of them. But for some of them, it could be a career-changing week. Definitely a life-changing week for, you know, you get a guy that wins that hasn't won. I just wish they would have a few more spots at tour school because, man, that was such a grind. I remember missing the second year after I lost my card the first year. I missed by a shot, and I still live at that, and I'm 62 years old, and I still think about where could I have found another shot that would have given me full status that year in 85.
As Rocco said earlier, play better. That's exactly what you did in 1995. Yeah. Jimmy, great to see you, buddy. We'll talk to you soon. Enjoy Greensboro.
All right, guys, no donuts this week. I'm going to stay away from them.
No donuts, no Dr. Pepper. When Golf Today returns, it's been an interesting week for Alabama golf alumni. Lee Hodges secured his first PGA Tour win at the 3M Open, while two-time major champ Justin Thomas is struggling to reach the FedEx Cup playoffs. Their college coach at Bama, Jay Sewell, is going to join us next to talk all things Tide. Back on Golf Today, Sunday at the 3M Open, Lee Hodges with his third into 18.
Had missed the fairway left, laid up. He'd already had two eagles in the final round, Damon, and this wasn't all that far away from being a third.
You want to talk about hitting it the right weight, the 16 inches, give or take. Got to do a little fist bump after that. Double fist bump. And the birdie to make it official. Seven-shot victory. Final round 67 for his first career win in 65 starts. And that's Bama coach Jay Sewell delivering a milkshake and a hug for the Bama alum. There he is. Now, think about this career. He actually transferred from UAB, did Lee Hodges, enrolled at Bama in August of 2016, was one of the most experienced golfers on the team with 35 career tournaments, 103 career rounds played, and earned all-region honors in his first season with the Tide, playing for Jay Sewell, who's been the Bama men's golf coach since 2002, couple of national championships, couple of runner-ups as well, four SEC titles. JT won the 2012 Haskins and Nicklaus Awards. Jay, a 2016 Golf Coaches Association of America Hall of Fame inductee as well, and began his career coaching at Anderson College and Augusta State. Great to have Jay with us on this Wednesday. The milkshake tradition, Jay, how did it start?
Well, it started with my dad a long time ago when we were in grade school. My dad was a golf professional, and if any time, it didn't matter if it was basketball or a great golf round or where you won, he said, let's go get a milkshake. I think there's two reasons. First, I think he was trying to teach us, you know, enjoy the winning. And the second, what he just loved ice cream. And so we've always done this in the Sewell family. And I started doing it when I started coaching at Anderson College. And I actually did it when I did little YMCA basketball. I carried on that tradition. And so we do it here, and it's kind of gone viral, I guess. We've always done it. And so it was really neat on Sunday that I got a chance to hand deliver a milkshake to Lee after winning his first PGA Tour event. What a special moment for me, but more important for him.
Who doesn't like winning an ice cream? Jay, you passed on recruiting Lee Hodges the first time around, and I read that your wife didn't have a particularly positive review of that decision of yours.
No, the story really is my son and Lee are a year apart, so my son played a lot of junior golf in the state, and so we got to see Lee a lot. And so in the end, you know, we only get 4.5 scholarships, and we only had room for one player in 2014. And so we chose somebody, Jonathan Hardy, who is actually one of Lee's best friends now. And my wife was going, you know, when I watch him play, he always shoots in the 60s, Jay. I don't know what you're thinking. We argue. I think she called me dumb. She says she didn't, but that's fine. But in the end, it was a perfect place for him. Alan Murray did a great job with him. And then when Alan left, Lee wanted really wanted his dream was to play at Alabama, and I wasn't going to mess up twice. So I did have a bogey early, but I did follow up with a birdie later.
Jay, Alabama and Minnesota aren't exactly next door. Why was it important for you to be there?
Well, we have a good friend, you know, in a nice way, he has a private jet, who has invested in Lee post college, and he's here. He's a big Bama alum also, and he goes, "I want to go up and support Lee. Would you like to go with me?" And so I did, and so, you know, it was nice to get up there. I couldn't get there without my friend Bill Best, who is actually, his company is on one of Lee's sleeves, and so it was an opportunity that, like I said, we were, you know, you're worried. He's got a 5-shot lead. We didn't want, you know, no matter what, we were going to hug his neck, and I'm just glad he was able to win, and it turned out to be a really, really special day.
On the surface, Jay, Lee and Justin Thomas seem very different personalities. You've obviously worked closely with both of them. What kind of traits do they share in common that have made both of them PGA Tour winners?
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, they are two totally polar opposite personalities, but they have the one common: they love this game. They love to compete. They want to win. They are determined in that mentally, and it shows in their actions, in their preparation. And so they, though their personalities and how they go through, you know, golf and life and everything are different, their love for the game and their preparation and their ability to work hard and to grind through tough times when we have them in golf and be able to sustain when you're doing well is, I think, is their attribute that I believe is the most important in golf. The love of the game is what will always get you up in the morning and keep working. If not, this game will truly beat you down.
Yeah, JT's having a tough time right now. How difficult has that been for you to watch him struggle, and have you offered him any advice?
Well, anytime you see your former players, like we just said, on one spectrum, we just watched Lee win, and that was incredibly satisfying and exciting. And anytime you see them miss cuts, and we have a lot of guys out there, you know, you hurt because they hurt. And but I did have talked with him. I usually leave him alone. You know, he's got a capable team. I'm a college golf coach, and I know that. But I love Justin to death for his couple years here. We have a great we have a lot of miles together and a lot of emotion together. And so I did call this to check on him. I'm not real worried about his game because his game is really good. And what I found out, and I was very excited to hear, he's actually in a pretty good place. Now, does he want to be playing a little bit better? Absolutely. And we talked about that. But I think the cameras on CBS on Saturday showed him working by himself on the range. And that's just who he is. And so he is in a really actually a pretty good place personally, which that's what I was worried about because I know golf will come back. In fact, he has good vibes at this course. You know, he's the youngest kid ever to make a cut was at this tournament, the Wyndham, when he was 15 years old. We were watching him and recruiting him during that time. So I reminded him of that, and he liked that. And so I'd be shocked if he doesn't have a great week this week.
I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit here, Jay. You're a college golf coach. You're accustomed to making tough decisions about who plays, who sits on the bench. Would you put JT on the Ryder Cup team now?
Well, first, yes, because I know what Justin's an incredible teammate, and there's a reason why, and I don't know if there's a lot of form right now at the back of the U.S. lineup anyway that somebody go, oh, this guy, maybe he's played a little bit better here or there. I think you would look at Justin's form in team competition, ours, Walker Cup, the President's Cup, and also the Ryder Cup, and I think he is an incredible teammate. He loves team golf. I think he's a great foursomes player, which I think is very important for the Ryder Cup because I think it's the hardest way to do it. And I think he's, like I said, being a great teammate. So to me, he's going to be great in the room. I think he adds energy, which also confidence. So two reasons. First, I love him. Second, I believe he would be a great fit and justified by doing that. Not just maybe current form, but what he's done in this, you know, form. And Italy is going to be very, very hard. I think if it was at home, it may be a little bit different. But being in Italy, I think you're going to need experienced players who've handled that situation. And I think that will bring out the best in him.
Big week for JT in Greensboro. Jay, great to see you. Thanks so much for the time. We'll speak to you down the road.
Sounds great. Roll Tide. Thanks for having me.